Did you see it? Did you see the videos that have gone viral on the news or are proliferating around Twitter? Or did you watch it in real time as the flames shot up the length of the towering spire of Notre Dame Cathedral? Did you see it for yourself, I mean, that elegant finger pointing at the heavens crack at about the halfway point and slowly, inexorably topple, only to fall onto the already burning roof? Did you see the blazing roof of the cathedral? And have you seen the images of the damage, the soot and charcoal everywhere, the near total destruction of one of the great hallowed places in the world? I say near total. Two-thirds of the roof is gone, leaving the cathedral open to the sky. The interior damage is still being assessed. The bell towers, so beloved of Victor Hugo's fictional Quasimodo, were spared. As of today, nobody is quite sure what caused the spire. The electrical problems and accident on the part of the reconstruction team working to preserve and shore up this nearly 800-year-old treasure. So far as we know, there is no reason to believe that the cathedral suffered anything but an accident. As I watched it, though, I flashed back on another cathedral destroyed by fire, and very much not by accident. During the Second World War, the Nazi regime tried to cow the British into submission by what the British called Baedeker raids, bombing runs to destroy historic sites that had been chosen by the famous Baedeker guidebooks as noteworthy. In November 1940, one of those bombing raids opened up Coventry Cathedral to the sky. The roof, the windows, the beautiful interior were reduced to smoldering, blackened rubble. Only the outer shell of the building survived. Seeing Notre Dame burn makes me realize the shock and loss the people of Coventry endured. Knowing that the treasure of their community was reduced to ruins because it had been awarded stars in a guidebook. And at least at Notre Dame, nobody was, as far as the reports tell us today, killed. One firefighter and two police officers injured, the firefighter seriously. But as of the latest report, no deaths. And God grant that it remains so. Coventry was not so fortunate. 568 people were killed, roughly 1,200 injured, nearly 900 of them seriously. Almost 8,000 houses were destroyed outright or so seriously damaged that the occupants had to be evacuated. The next day, the very next day, the cathedral provost, Richard Howard, chalked on the wall of the ruined sanctuary the words, "Father, forgive." Before the fires had died down, before it was safe to inspect the damage inside, Coventry Cathedral began its ministry of reconciliation. While the losses were fresh, while the outcome of the battle was far from clear, while the war looked like it would end with fascism triumphant, decency buried in rubble and scorched wood, when it was safe to enter the ruined, shattered cathedral, the people of Coventry doubled down on Howard's bold stance. A stonemason named Jock Forbes built an altar from the rubble. Behind it, two charred, twisted roof beams, still attached to each other, stood as the cross behind the altar. Forbes had carved the words, "Father, forgive," into this altar. I have been told that at the first service in the shell of the cathedral, under the twisted, blackened cross and the open sky, those unjust skies that had rained down devastation and death so recently, that the people of Coventry prayed for their losses, yes, but also for the souls of the German pilots who had inflicted those losses. A few weeks later, on Christmas Day, Provost Howard spoke over the radio from the ruins. He asked all those who were listening to banish all thoughts of revenge and called on them to make a kinder, simpler world, a more Christ-child-like world. Coventry had taken its stand. It has devoted itself to a mission of forgiveness ever since. Half a century later, on my first trip to England, we stopped at the new cathedral next to the ancient ruin. I was drawn into the ruins, partly by my lack of affection for modern architecture, and found myself pulled by the inscription on the altar to the twisted, blackened cross. And at once, I was confronted with the best and worst of humanity. I don't need to specify the worst. The ruins had been tidied up, shored up, cleaned. But the house of worship was a vestige, literally a shell. But inside that shell was a pearl beyond all price, like the one in the gospel. That pearl was the echo resounding from that day to the present of people at their very best, following the example of Jesus Christ on the cross as he prayed for his persecutors with his rasping, dying breath. In that moment, standing there, I wasn't thinking. I was in awe. And then it clicked in my mind. This is what we are meant to be. It's all real. Every bit of it, if we choose it, grasp it, and try to live it. I say try advisedly because we fail. All of us. Anyone who's driven in a traffic jam with me knows that that is true. But at our best, we can follow the example of Jesus on the cross and forgive those who have hurt us. And we'd better get on it, because we are a long way off from that kinder, simpler, more Christ-child-like world that Richard Howard called for in Christmas 1940. We seem further from it than ever we have been in my lifetime. Our British friends are riven by conflict over Brexit. Our own politics are defaced with division and distrust curdling into contempt. We need the cross today more than ever. And these words of Jesus call us to do better. Because Jesus did, and Jesus still does. Maybe it's because he knows us better than we know ourselves, and is able to understand how easy it is to fool ourselves into the worst betrayals, the worst crimes. After all, Peter has denied him out of fear. Judas has sold him for profit. The temple authorities have betrayed him to the hated Roman occupiers. And the Romans, well, imagine that special kind of betrayal, of finding in the occupier of your nation someone who understands exactly what is going on, knows that you're not guilty, and then, as a matter of political expediency, sends you to an agonizing death anyway. And yet he gasps, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." It's all too common and all too tempting to read these words to mean that the whole cast of characters who betrayed Jesus that night and that day would have acted better if only they'd known he was the Messiah. But that glib, easy reasoning lets us off the hook. It protects us from the duty to forgive. It allows us to hold on to our self-righteousness, our appalling certainty that we are right, and they, define the term yourself, are wrong. And only afterward do we realize that that certainty is a betrayal of all Jesus taught us. Like Peter, like Judas, perhaps even like Pilate, like Paul in Acts when the scales fall from his eyes, only afterwards do they understand the enormity of what it is they have done. And not just because Jesus was the Messiah, but because they have, in betraying Jesus, betrayed that which was best in themselves. As we do, as I do, when we burn bright with self-righteousness at the terrible things that happen in our poor world, and we give ourselves permission to hate whoever we think is responsible for them, to deny their humanity. As we do, as I do, when we feel that wonderful sense of justified anger, and give into it. As we do, as I do, when we accept an unjust status quo and convince ourselves there is nothing to be done, that so the world is, when in fact it is so that we have made the world. Father, forgive us, for we know not what we do.